All right, take your Bibles this morning, if you will. Let's go to Ecclesiastes, the third chapter, as we did last week. I'd like to read those same verses to you. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and beginning with verse 1. It says, "To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace." Now, we're going to center in, of course, on verse 8 in particular, but let me go back to verse 7. It says, "A time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak up." I believe that, indeed, this is a time that our pastors across this land need to speak up. But if they do so, they need to do it in a biblical fashion. And I fear, or I shouldn't use that word, but I'm afraid, or I shouldn't use that word, but I, the point being is that I think that far too many preachers are not going to be dealing with the issue at hand from a biblical perspective. Verse 8 says, "A time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. This will be war in Iraq, too, unfinished business, and this will be part two of what will probably be a three-part series." We have been told time and again in the recent months, and especially here in the last month, in the last 2 weeks, that now is a time for war, and indeed that's what Ecclesiastes says, that there is a time for war. And we've been told time and again that this is a time for war as it concerns war with Iraq. That's at least certainly how some people are viewing it. However, we should be asking ourselves this question first, and that is that how Yahweh views this war, or is it simply the view of those who, for self-serving interest, want to see the regime of Saddam Hussein toppled? We're also being told, I'm sure you've heard this more than once probably, that it's unpatriotic to oppose this war. This last week, I received a newsletter from Zola Levitt, a self-proclaimed, quote-unquote, Jewish Christian. And therein, he essentially equated opposition to the war with Iraq. Now, listen to this. He essentially equated opposition to the war with Iraq as also being, quote, anti-Israel, meaning, of course, anti-Israel lie, Israeli. Because there is indeed a difference, and if those who receive this tape don't know the difference, then they should contact me, and I will provide them with plenty of material that shows the difference. But again, he said, he essentially equated opposition to the war with Iraq as quote-unquote anti-Israel and catch this, anti-Semitic in the worst way, end of quote. Whoa. Now that ought to, stop a minute, that ought to sound off some bells in our head. At the very least, it should tell you something about this war. That statement should tell you something about this war, and very possibly at whose behest it's being fought. What Levitt actually wrote was that anyone who supports Iraq, quote, let me put it in quotes, quote, anyone who supports Iraq is anti-Israel and anti-Semitic in the worst way, end of quote. And that, let me assure you, is precisely how today's warmongers want to portray those opposed to this war. But let me assure you that to be opposed to this war is not necessarily to be in support of Iraq or Saddam Hussein's regime. Now, they want to make it look that way. It's unpatriotic, and if you're opposed to the war, then you're supporting Iraq and Saddam. But it's not necessarily that way. That equation or parallelism certainly may be true for some people. I'm sure it is for some Iraqis, and maybe others. But it's certainly not true, I'll guarantee you, when it comes to this preacher and multitudes of other people who oppose this war. I oppose this war, but I certainly do not support Saddam and his regime. Now, let's go back and visit the idea of patriotism, or probably what I should say, the accusation of unpatriotism. Here is a very interesting quote concerning patriotism. And I want you, as I read it, to see if you can figure out who wrote it or who said it. Quote, "Naturally, the common people don't want war. But after all, it is the leaders of a country who determine the policy. And it's always a simple matter to drag people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. This is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked and denounce the pacifist for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country." End of quote. Any ideas? I'm sure you probably can't come up with it. Excuse me? No, it's not the protocols. Hermann Göring, Hitler's Reich Marshal, speaking at the Nuremberg trials following World War II. Now, what do you think? Do you think that all the people of Germany were little Hitlers? Or do you think that the German people just got caught up in the cause of quote-unquote patriotism? I think that probably everyone would agree that it was the latter. They weren't all just a little bit of bunch of Hitlers, but they all got caught up in this idea of patriotism for their country. Beware, America. Quote, "Beware of the leader who bangs the drums of war in order to whip the citizenry into a patriotic fervor. For patriotism is indeed, listen to this, a double-edged sword. It both emboldens the blood just as it narrows the mind. And when the drums of war have reached a fervor pitch and the blood boils with hate and the mind is closed, the leader will have no need in seizing the rights of the citizenry. Rather, the citizenry, infused with fear and blinded by patriotism, will offer up all of their rights unto the leader and do it gladly so. How do I know? I know, for this is what I have done. And I am Caesar." End of quote. Julius Caesar. Now, that should ring some bells as well. Because I will tell you, we have lost more rights in the last 2 years in this cause of patriotism than we've lost in the last 200, or certainly in the last 50. In the first message of this series, I particularly addressed President Bush and his claim to Christianity. And I did so for more than one reason, but particularly I did so because whether people realize it or not, they compare the leaders of the two principal nations involved in this military conflict in which we are now involved. Saddam is a cruel, despotic, oppressive dictator. And the list of adjectives describing his wickedness and his despotism and his the depravity of Saddam and his regime is nearly endless. But even if you don't think that with all of that that's being said about Saddam, and certainly much of it probably true, but if you don't think, or even if you don't think, that there is any comparison between Saddam and Bush, I hope after having heard the first message that at the very least you don't believe that President Bush is a Christian or anything close to it. Hopefully, having heard that message, you know that that certainly cannot be true, at least not by the Bible standards of what the Bible describes and demands for a Christian man. Don't fall into the trap of comparing or weighing one man's evil against another man's evil. Now, man is prone to do that. We are that's a trap that we can easily find ourselves falling into. However, to Yahweh, the God of the Bible, let me assure you, evil is simply evil. He doesn't weigh the evil of one man compared to another man. Evil is simply evil. If one man, for example, has raped only one woman, and another man has raped a dozen women, do you really think that the first man is any less evil in Yahweh's sight than the second man? I don't think anybody would believe that. In fact, if you do, or you have inclinations to think that might be the case, let me read to you James 2, chapter 9 and verses 9 through 11, where James wrote, he says, "But if you have respect to persons, you commit sin and are convinced of the law as transgressors. For, listen to this, it says, for whosoever shall keep the whole law, and yet whosoever shall keepeth the whole law, and yet offendeth in one point of the law of God," that is, it says, "he is guilty of all." And again, that kind of puts us all in the same boat, doesn't it? For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And it's not like that you've fallen further short than I have, or I've fallen further short than you have. No, it doesn't matter how many times you've broken the law or how many times I've broken the law. We're guilty of it all if we've done it once. Then it goes on, he says, "For he that said, 'Do not commit adultery,' said also, 'Do not kill,'" or "do not murder. Now, if thou commit no adultery, yet if thou kill, thou hast become a transgressor of the law." End of quote. Listen to me. God is no respecter of persons. That's where we started. But if you have respect to persons, you commit sin. God doesn't sin. He doesn't respect persons, and he doesn't respect or weigh the sins of people. Evil is evil in his sight. Therefore, the question is not whether Bush is as evil as Saddam, but rather, or simply, whether Bush is evil. And by extension, whether this war is godly or ungodly. In this message, I propose to demonstrate to you that this war is indeed an ungodly war, an ungodly military conflict. And that although it is time for war, that cannot be denied, we're in it. Although it is time in war, it may very well therefore be one for which this nation is judged by Almighty God. It may be just another means for God saying, "Here's another reason for me to judge you along with all your other sins." Now, in order to determine whether this military engagement is godly or ungodly, we of course must go to the Bible. The Bible is the only means to determine that. Not all this propaganda that's flowing around, and not from the fact that the man who's leading our nation into it claims to be a Christian, or anything else. The Bible is the means, is the only means, to determine whether this is a godly or ungodly conflict. To what will probably be many a liberal pacifist's surprise and chagrin, the Bible does not outright condemn warfare, or I should say, righteous warfare. Warfare according to the Bible. You mean there is such a thing, warfare according to the Bible? Well, you better believe it. What might also surprise many a New Testament Christian, the Bible actually provides rules of warfare. There's one chapter in the book of Deuteronomy that's particularly devoted to the rules of warfare, and then you find them in other places as well, that can therefore be utilized as a measuring stick to determine the godliness or ungodliness, as the case may be, of any military campaign in which we find ourselves involved, including the one we are in now. So, how does this war with Iraq measure up to the Bible's requirements for a godly or righteous war? Well, quite frankly, it fails. Now, I guess you're not surprised by that with what I've preempted all of this with. But quite frankly, it fails. And I intend to look at only two of the biblical qualifiers. But keep in mind that this war only needs to fail in one to be deemed ungodly. To be godly, it must fulfill all of the requirements for godly, for the rules of war as found in the Bible. I'm only going to deal with two, but only one would suffice to prove it ungodly. To begin with, War must be, now listen to me, war must be, according to the Bible, defensive, not aggressive, unless specifically ordained by Yahweh. As when, for example, Yahweh had preordained and given the land of Canaan to Abraham's descendants. And therefore it was preordained that they take the offense, or what was certainly considered by the Canaanites as the aggressive stance in that particular war they fought with the Canaanites. But that war, that offensive war, had been preordained by Yahweh. Otherwise, war should be reserved for the defense of one's country when that nation itself is threatened by another nation. Let's turn to prove the point of this, so you just don't have to take my word for it. Let's turn to the book of Numbers, chapter 10. Numbers chapter 10, we're just going to read one verse. Numbers chapter 10 and verse 9, it says, "And if you go to warfare, And if ye go to warfare in your land against the enemy that oppresseth you, then you shall blow an alarm with the trumpets, and you shall be remembered before Yahweh your God, and you shall be saved from your enemies." Now, I don't know if you've read that before, or if you've maybe read it many times, but very possibly you've read it and never caught what it really said. Note, quote, "If you go to war in your land against an enemy that oppresses you," end of quote. Let me give you, with that in mind, let me give you a quick three-question quiz. And I don't think that there's anyone in America or Iraq, or for that matter anywhere else in the world, who won't ace this quiz. Let me give you three questions here. Question number one, was Bush given special revelation from Yahweh in which he was charged to go to war with Iraq? Yes or no? No. Not even Bush himself has claimed that, and you know if he had got it, he would be claiming it. Never was claimed, never happened. Question number two, whose land is being invaded? America's or Iraq's? Don't you think everybody's going to ace this one? It's Iraq's. And question number three, who therefore is the aggressor or the oppressor in this war with Iraq? Well, nobody's going to get this one wrong either. The United States of America. Elementary Holmes, as Sherlock Holmes, Elementary Watson, as Sherlock Holmes would say, they are not oppressing us. We are oppressing them. They are not invading our land. We are invading their land. And therefore, simply put, on count number one, according to the Bible, this is an ungodly war. Yeah, but listen, preacher, we live in a nuclear day and age when another nation doesn't have to actually invade another nation in order to threaten one's peace, safety, and welfare. Well, how very true that is. And certainly we of all nations should know it, because it was the United States of America who introduced nuclear warfare into the military arena and first used it on Japan. But how true that is, and that has to be considered in light of Numbers chapter 10 and verse 9, in applying that passage to the day in which we find that we are living. But don't you think that for another nation to actually be a nuclear threat, that they would have to actually have nuclear weapons and to have threatened us with them? Oops, I guess it was a four-question quiz. But that's another question that I'll guarantee you anybody else can ace that one as well, or answer correctly. Iraq has neither threatened us nor possesses nuclear weapons of any kind. Simply put, such capabilities cannot be hid. Take, for example, or maybe I should say in contrast, take North Korea. There's no question. They've got or are building those capabilities. The manufacture of nuclear weapons emits gamma rays. Not the shooting off of the weapon. The manufacture of the weapon emits gamma rays that can be detected by satellite imagery or other advanced technologies. And quite frankly, there has been no detection. Or you know as well as I do that Bush would have used it in his propaganda arsenal for this war. It's never happened. The following is an article, or part of an article, by Dan Strober entitled Checking False U.S. Lees Wasted Time, found in Mercury News. I'll just read part of this to you. It's a little bit lengthy, but I think it's worth a read. It says, quote, none of the nuclear-related intelligence trumpeted by the administration is held up to scrutiny, inspectors say. From suspect aluminum tubes, remember the tubes they found? Oh, they gave pictures of them? We finally found evidence. Well, according to this, it says from suspect, and I've heard this from other sources as well, by the way, it says from suspect aluminum tubes to aerial photographs to documents revealed to be forgeries that claim to link Iraq to uranium from Niger, inspectors say they chased U.S. leads that went nowhere and wasted valuable time in their efforts to determine the extent of Saddam Hussein's arsenal of weapons banned after the 1991 Persian Gulf War. The administration said the Iraqi aluminum tubes were uniquely suited for centrifuges to make bomb-grade uranium. But UN officials argue that the Iraqi explanation that the tubes were destined to become artillery rockets was more plausible. And keep in mind, the Iraqis, like any other nation, have the right to have weapons to defend themselves. And that's what these would have been. Moreover, it goes on, the source close to the inspector said, the U.S. military uses similar tubes for a rocket known as the Hydra 70. Continuing, in October, the White House released aerial photos of activity at former Iraqi nuclear facilities. The inspectors, however, found no sign of weapons activity and suggested that Saddam was not likely to reuse known nuclear sites. In February, the administration said trucks were spotted at facilities shortly before the arrival of inspectors, apparently to haul away and hide banned equipment. Of course, that was just an accusation. It was just supposition. It was certainly never proven. But in one case, it continues, according to the UN official, the trucks were fire engines standing by the building for safety reasons. In the case of the Niger documents, they appeared genuine at first glance. Accurate nomenclature, proper stamps, but further study turned up crude errors such as words misspelled in French and dates that did not match the day of the week. Who created the counterfeit document remains a mystery. The nuclear inspectors trudged through the Iraqi countryside for months. They found the Iraqi weapons infrastructure built at great expense in the 1980s to be in a state of decay. They sought out-of-the-way machine shops or companies where Iraqi scientists might be congregated, but they found no sign of an organized nuclear weapons program, and end of quote. And what about since invading Iraq? Since invading Iraq, the military has likewise come up empty-handed with any substantiation for Bush's claims to Iraq's possession of weapons of any kind of mass destruction. Or any kind of weapons of mass destruction, I should say. Here's an article entitled, Search for a Smoking Gun Draws a Blank. Subtitled, U.S. and Britain's Case for War Undermined by Special Forces' Failure to Find Illegal Arms at 10 Suspected Sites. This is by Nicholas Watt, Monday, March 31st, 2003, in The Guardian. I will share part of it as well. Quote, Britain and the United States suffered a fresh blow last night when their main justification war was undermined by reports that special forces have failed to find any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. As Tony Blair launched a charm offensive to persuade the Arab world to understand his decision to go to war, senior officials in Washington said that intelligence information about weapons of mass destruction at 10 sites had proved to be unfounded. The Washington Post reported yesterday that tests had proved negative at all, quote-unquote, urgent sites in the western desert. Quote, within a quote, all the searches have turned up negative, end of quote, a staff officer told the newspaper. Quote, within a quote, the munitions have been found the munitions that have been found have all been conventional, end of quote. Special operation forces from the U.S., Britain, and Australia are understood to have seized the sites, which were believed by U.S. Central Command to house chemical warheads, Scud missiles, and eight-wheeled transport erector launchers known as TELs. Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary, attempted to play down the findings. He told ABC's This Week that banned weapons were not in areas controlled by Allied forces. Well, that's exactly where they said they were before. Now they're, all of a sudden they're not there because they can't find them, couldn't find them before, and they really don't even exist, more than likely. He goes on quoting Rumsfeld, quote within a quote, "We know where they are. They are in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north of that," quote, end of quote, he said. But the failure to uncover weapons at sites identified or previously identified by intelligence will be a severe blow to Tony Blair and George Bush, who attacked Iraq on the basis that Saddam Hussein has the weapons, end of quote. They couldn't find them in months with the UN teams that went in before, and they haven't been able to find them now that they've taken control of the country. Should tell us something. Furthermore, one of the key documents that supposedly, and this was referred to in the previous article, one of the key documents that supposedly demonstrated Iraq's nuclear capabilities, or at least intentions, that is that Iraq had sought to purchase uranium from Niger, has proven to be an absolute fabrication, or as some people call a hoax. Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat from California, wrote an 8-page letter March 17th to the White House concerning this. I'm just going to read a very short portion of it. Here's what he said, quote, "It has become incontrovertibly clear that a key piece of evidence you and other administration officials have cited regarding Iraq's efforts to obtain nuclear weapons is a hoax," wrote Representative Waxman. Quote within a quote, or, quote, "This is a breach of the highest order, and the American people are entitled to know how it happened," end of quote. By the way, it's not the only one that has been pretty much identified as a hoax. Some of what the black who was the general, Colin Powell, some of what Colin Powell presented before the UN has proved to be also to be forgery and hoaxes as well. But let's think about this. Even if Iraq has nuclear capabilities or has other weapons of mass destruction, keep in mind, Saddam has never, never threatened the United States. In fact, he is no threat to the United States, except as one Pastor Brown pointed out in his newsletter, except that we've opened up the borders and allow anybody to come in and deal with us here on the shore. But other than that, and in fact, it's been proven, Iraq right now has had very little, if any, ties to any kind of terrorism. It's the other ones that we've got to worry about. You know, I wonder why President Bush didn't listen to the counsel of the outgoing Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, who informed the incoming President Bush in January 2000 that, quote, "Iraq no longer poses a military threat to its neighbors," end of quote. And listen to me, if he was no threat then to his neighbors, he was certainly no threat to the United States of America. Moreover, if President Bush's reasons for war against Iraq because of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction are legitimate, well, why then the free pass for North Korea and other nations which with much greater potential and who pose a much greater threat than Iraq does? Why the free pass for those nations? Iraq's, for example, Iraq's missiles, consider this. Iraq's missiles have a potential distance of 93 miles. Iran's missiles have the potential distance of 880 miles. How about Israel's missiles? Israel's missiles, the Israelis, have the potential of missiles that will have a range of 2,100 miles. And North Korea's can reach the United States of America. And that's not to mention China's and Russia's. Of course, you've probably heard the objection that in this nuclear age in which we live, we can't wait for a threat. You heard that one? You know? We can't wait for the... They know he's never threatened America, but if he's got him, we can't wait for the threat. We must take preemptive measures before it occurs. Well, then, why in the world did we pick first Iraq, of all places, if that's the case? Why not China? Why not North Korea or Russia? In fact, if Bush's reasoning is legitimate, and with the fact that the United States of America has of late been the most aggressive and threatening of all nations, aside from the Israelis, then other nations, using his reasoning, would seem to have good reason to invade us. You know, there's not one thing that Iraq has been accused of, and in many cases falsely accused of, that we're not guilty of. We've got the weapons of mass destruction more than anybody in the world. Have we threatened people? You better believe we threatened people. In fact, we don't have any problem going in and invading people, invading other sovereign nations. And therefore, if his reasoning is valid, then it's just as reasoning for them as it is for us. We've got more weapons of mass destruction than any other nation, and we've got them. And that's not debatable. Because we are the aggressor, the oppressor, in this war with Iraq, and because we have invaded Iraq with no legitimate threat or provocation on their part, according to Numbers chapter 10 and verse 9, alone, this war is ungodly and should not be supported by Christians. Now, I know you don't want to be teamed up with the likes of the Hollywood bunch and the other liberal pacifists, but, you know, too bad. Sometimes the far left finds themselves in the right cause. We may not agree on anything else, but if you take the right goes far enough, and the left goes far enough, they're going to meet on the backside and have some things in common. I don't want to be grouped with them, but just because I don't want to be grouped with them doesn't mean I'm not going to take the biblical stand when it comes to this war. This war is ungodly, and we should not support it. Furthermore, it should go without saying that war should be only fought for just causes, which is the second biblical criteria for a godly war. King David certainly understood this. Turn with me to Psalms, the book of Psalms, Psalm 35. Psalm 35, beginning with verse 1, it says, "Plead my cause, O Yahweh, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me." And then jump down to verses 7 and 8. He says, "For without cause," in other words, without a just cause, "for without cause have they hid for me in their net," excuse me, "for without cause have they hid for me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul." And then he says in verse 8, "Therefore let destruction come upon him at unawares." Those who would come after me, or anyone else for that matter, without a just cause, he says, "Let destruction come upon him at unawares, and let his net that he has hid catch himself into that very destruction, let him fall." David wrote those words knowing firsthand all about that, because Saul and others had waged war. You remember Saul had waged war against him without just cause. But David also applied this same biblical principle on warfare to himself as well, not only to his enemies, but he knew if it applied to his enemies that it applied to himself as well. Turn to Psalm chapter 7. Psalm chapter 7 and verses 1 through 5. Verse 1, it says, "O Yahweh my God, in thee do I put my trust. Save me from all them that persecute me and deliver me. Lest he tear my soul like a lion, rending it in pieces while there is none to deliver." Verse 3, "O Yahweh my God, if I have done this, if there be iniquity in my hands," and especially verse 4, "if I have rewarded evil unto him that was at peace with me," in other words, if I have done this when there's no just cause, if I've been unjust in my cause, he says, "if I have rewarded evil unto him that was at peace with me, yea, if I have delivered him that without cause is my enemy, let the enemy persecute my soul and take it, Yea, let him tread down my life upon the earth and lay my honor in the dust. Verse 4, particularly in the New American Standard Version, puts it this way. He says, if I have rewarded evil to my friend, New American Standard said, he who is at peace with me, or have plundered him without cause, or have plundered him who without cause was my adversary. End of quote. Now let me ask you this. Has Saddam ever threatened us with war, either back in the 1990s or here now, recently? Of course he hasn't. Because that's why they say we can't wait for the threat. We have to take preemptive action. He's never threatened us. Or instead he did then, and he has done now everything in his power to stay out of war. Didn't he do it then? He did everything he could. He offered the same peace terms, nearly identical with Papa Bush, that he did with Junior Bush. Everything to possibly. Now, did he cooperate fully with everything the UN wanted him to do? Probably not. Don't think he did. But the question is, were their requests upon him reasonable or unreasonable? Did he have reason to mistrust them and not to allow his people to go out of the country, not knowing what they would say and further build a case against him? I don't know whether it was all that was going on there, but I know he did nearly everything possible to stay at peace. And even if he wasn't doing it for that motive, the fact is he has never threatened America. In fact, Saddam and Iraq were America's allies right up to when Senior Bush decided to go war against them the first time. Now think about it. Why in the world would Saddam desire to want to go to war with the U.S. and her allies' war machine? It would be suicide. That makes no more sense than, I mean, we may be dumbed down, but are we that dumbed down? It would be suicide, unless, of course, Yahweh intervened on his behalf in judgment of America. Otherwise, it's suicide. And therefore, it would certainly appear, according to what we just read in the book of Psalms, that America is rewarding evil unto him who was at peace with him, and plundering Iraq without cause, or certainly without a just cause. And what do you mean without cause? Somebody's going to come back at me, I'm sure. What do you mean without cause? My goodness, preacher, what about 9/11? My response to that is, yeah, what about 9/11? If 9/11's terrorist attacks upon America are justification for warfare against another nation, then why aren't we at war with Saudi Arabia rather than Iraq? After all, 15 of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, not Iraq. There wasn't one of them that came from Iraq. And the vast majority of the money used to finance the 9/11 attacks on America also came from Saudi Arabia. So why aren't we at war with Saudi Arabia instead of Iraq? There are no ties to Iraq or Saddam to 9/11. None whatsoever. Okay, preacher, then what about the liberation of the innocent Iraqi people from a cruel dictator who gassed his own people? Isn't that a just cause? You've heard that one, haven't you? How many times have you heard about that? Have you heard that one? Well, to begin with, could it be that America is just a little bit hypocritical with this one? Maybe just a little bit? America's government, or regime, if you prefer, maybe Senator Kerry had it right this last week. He's taken a lot of flack for that. But maybe he had it right. But I'm not saying it, I'm just saying if you prefer. But America's government, or regime, if you prefer, has been responsible for the murder of 40 million innocent people under the guise of a woman's right to choose. So, therefore, does another nation now have the right to invade us and topple our government? Saddam is accused of killing 100,000. That's the figures that they usually throw out there, that he's been accused of killing 100,000 people, of his own people. And very possibly he has. America Bush included because of some of his legislation since becoming president, is responsible for the lives of 40 million people. And oh, by the way, you should know this. Infanticide, known as abortion here in America, is outlawed in Iraq. And let's just spend a little time on the accusation that we've heard over and over and over again that Saddam gassed his own people. Fact or just more war propaganda? If the truth be known, it is much more likely that it was Syria who gassed those Iranian Kurds in March of 1988. At the termination of the Iran-Iraq War, Professor Stephen Pelletier, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and Leif Rosenberger and Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Johnson of the U.S. Army War College undertook a study of the chemical weapons used by Iran and Iraq in order to better understand battlefield chemical warfare. Now, they undertook it. They were the ones who did the study of the chemical warfare that went on between Iran and Iraq. What do you think they have to say about this particular incident of the Iraqi Kurds being gassed? Well, I'll let you hear it from their own pen, or at least one of them. Stephen C. Pelletier, in an article entitled A War Crime or an Act of War. Here's part of what he wrote. He said, "The accusation that Iraq has used chemical weapons against its citizens is a familiar part of the debate. The piece of hard evidence most frequently brought up concerns the gassing of the Iraqi Kurds at the town of Halajabah, or something like that, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, in March 1988, near the end of the eight-year Iran-Iraq war. President Bush himself cited Iraq's, quote, gassing its own people, end of quote, specifically at Halajabah, as a reason to topple Saddam Hussein. But the truth is, all we know for certain is that the Kurds were bombarded with poison gas that day at Halajabah. We cannot say with any certainty that Iraqi chemical weapons killed the Kurds. This is, and he goes on, he says, this is not the only distortion of the Halajabah story. I am in a position to know, because as the Central Intelligence Agency senior political analyst on Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, and as a professor at the Army War College from 1988 to 2000, I was privy to much of the classified material that flowed through Washington having to do with the Persian Gulf. In addition, I headed a 1991 Army investigation into how the Iraqis would fight a war against the United States. The classified version of the report went into great detail on the Halajabah affair. This much about the gassing of Halajabah we undoubtedly know. It came about in the course of a battle between Iraqis and Iranians. Iraq used chemical weapons to try to kill Iranians who had seized the town. Didn't hear that before, did we? That the Iranians had seized the town. Again, Iraq used chemical weapons to try to kill Iranians who had seized the town, which is in northern Iraq, not far from the Iranian border. The Kurdish civilians who died had the misfortune to be caught up in that exchange. In other words, they weren't the intended victims. But they were not Iraqi's main target, he said. And the story gets murkier. Immediately after the battle, the United States Defense Intelligence Agency investigated and produced a classified report which circulated within the intelligence community on a need-to-know basis. The study asserted that it was Iranian gas that killed the Kurds, not Iraqi gas. The agency did find that each side used gas against the other in the battle around Halajabah. The condition of the dead Kurds' bodies, however, indicated they had been killed with a blood agent, that is, cyanide-based gas, which Iran was known to use. The Iraqis, who are thought to have used mustard gas in the battle, are not known to have possessed blood agents at that time. These facts have long been in the public domain, but extraordinarily, as often as the Halajabah affair is cited, they are rarely mentioned. End of quote. And I'd venture to say you've never heard it mentioned, as I hadn't until here recently and read this report and others on the same affair. Wonder why? Maybe it's war propaganda by a side who doesn't have just cause for this war and thus has to create it. But what if Saddam had gassed his own people?
wouldn't it then be a just cause for a war? Well, very possibly. But not for us. Simply put, the affairs of another sovereign nation is none of our business. George Washington, our first president, understood that, and I should have shared, should have brought some of his quotes in that regard. Just like our problems, our sins are none of their business. And we wouldn't want their nose poking into our business any more than they want us, our nose poking into theirs. Get this down, Americans. Yahweh never commissioned us, the United States of America, to be the world's policeman. My goodness, who are we to police anyone? We can't even morally police ourselves properly. Furthermore, as someone I read put it, why should we send our sons and daughters, and by the way, our daughters being over there is another thing that makes this an ungodly war, but why should we send our sons and daughters to spill their blood for a cause, that is, for Iraqi's liberation, that the Iraqis themselves haven't been willing to shed their own blood for? So where's the just cause in all of this? Oh, I almost forgot. Of course, it's a just war because of the Iraqis' non-compliance to UN resolutions. We've heard that one several times, haven't we? Well, don't forget that the smoking gun for non-compliance has yet to be provided. That's just nothing but an accusation. And even then, if it's true, is it reason for a war? Furthermore, why don't we invade the Israelis if this is a just cause for going to war with another nation? I possess a list of 65 UN resolutions that Israel has never complied with between 1955 to 1992. Let me provide you with some of them. Resolution 162, and get this one in particular. Resolution 162 that urged Israel to comply with UN resolutions. That tells the story there. They don't comply with UN resolutions. And so they even made a resolution that you've got to comply with UN resolutions. Resolutions 237 that urged Israel to allow the return of new 1967 Palestinian refugees. Ignored. Resolution 279 that demanded withdrawal of Israeli forces from Lebanon. Resolutions 285 that demanded immediate withdrawal from Lebanon. Resolutions 313 that demanded Israel to stop attacking Lebanon. Starting to sound like a broken record, isn't it? I wonder why. Because they never complied. They never would. Resolution 425 that called on Israel to withdraw its forces from Lebanon. There we go again. Resolution 450, the same thing. Resolution after resolution on the same thing, and they never did comply. Resolutions 484 that declared it imperative that Israel readmit two imported Palestinian mayors. Resolutions 497 that determined Israel's annexation of Syria's Golan Heights as being null and void, and that demanded that Israel rescind its decision forthwith. Again, denied, ignored, never followed through with. Resolution 498 that called on Israel to withdraw from Lebanon. There it is again. The same with 501 and 509. Resolution 518 that demanded that Israel cooperate fully with the UN forces in Lebanon. That one sounds familiar, you know. Same thing they were telling Iraq. You've got to comply, cooperate fully with the UN forces, the U.S. team that's in Iraq. No difference. And Resolution 799 that strongly condemned Israel's deportation of 413 Palestinians and called for their immediate return. Those are just 14 of the 65 resolutions, UN resolutions, completely ignored by the Israelis. And oh, I also have a list of 30 different vetoes by the United States of America between September 1972 and 1990 to protect the Israelis from council criticism. And we have the gall to condemn France for using their veto power this one time? And we did it 30 times to protect the Israelis? Now listen to me. All of the Bush administration's arguments, pretext, rationale, and justifications for this war is just propaganda to cover up their real reasons, which, Lord willing, we'll get into the next and final message. And we all know that. It's just a matter of whether we're going to admit it or not. The reasons we've been fed for going to war with Iraq kind of remind me of this little song. And you know the tune. If you can figure out the words, you can join me in singing it. It goes like this. If you cannot find Osama, bomb Iraq. If the markets are a drama, bomb Iraq. If the terrorists are frisky, Pakistan is looking shifty, North Korea is too risky, bomb Iraq. If we have no allies with us, bomb Iraq. If we think someone has dissed us, bomb Iraq. So to heck with the inspections, let's look tough for the elections. Close your mind and take directions, bomb Iraq. It's preemptive, not aggression, bomb Iraq. Let's prevent this mass destruction, bomb Iraq. They've got weapons, we can't see them, and that's good enough for me, 'cause it's all the proof I need, bomb Iraq. If you've never were elected, bomb Iraq. If your mood is quite dejected, bomb Iraq. If you think Saddam's gone mad with the weapons that he had and he tried to kill your dad, bomb Iraq. If your corporate fraud is growing, bomb Iraq. If your ties to it are showing, bomb Iraq. If your politics are sleazy and hiding that ain't easy and your manhood's getting queasy, bomb Iraq. Fall in line and follow orders, bomb Iraq. For our might knows not our borders, bomb Iraq. Disagree, we'll call it treason. Let's make war, not love, this season. Even if we have no reason, bomb Iraq. Pretty good little song. How true, and yet how sad, and how tragic. And let me just conclude this part of this series by simply assuring you that this war with Iraq is neither defensive nor does it have a just cause. And therefore, it is indeed ungodly. And someday, if our God be true to His Word and true to the numerous examples in the Old Testament of His judgment upon such nations who did such deeds, we will be judged for it. No, it may not happen immediately. No, we may not lose this war any more than we lost the next one. But we may just lose the next one, or God may have some other way to deal with us. But the fact remains, whether He deals with us soon or later, it's still ungodly, and we shouldn't be supporting it. Lord willing, in the next message, we'll get into the four real reasons for this war. Let's stand and we'll close this one in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we thank You and praise and glorify You, knowing that You are sovereign, that You're indeed still in control of all, and that this war will be used in one fashion or another for Your purposes. Forgive us, Father, for our sins, and I pray, Lord, that You would not hold the innocent guilty in this case, and that in wrath You'd remember mercy when it comes to judgment, that You'd have mercy on the innocent and the remnant, Father, who do not support this ungodliness or any other ungodliness that our nation sometimes participates in. Father, use this and, Father, Your Word and Your truths to awaken our people, to help them to see and to not be caught up in this patriotic fervor that blinds the heart while it emboldens the blood. Father, awaken us again, I pray, and keep us, Father, from this self-destructive path that we've put ourselves on. We ask for our leaders and we ask for our soldiers. We ask that You'd return them home soon. And Father, that You would again protect the innocent. But Father, that You'd stop this war in one fashion or another and keep us from committing these sins that we are so bent on doing at this time in our history. We ask these things and we praise You for them and we glorify You now in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.